Simon Mercet, and welcome to Crave. This is the podcast and video cast dedicated to music, to film, to theatre, to television, to just about anything that's been entertaining me and my erstwhile colleague Steve McCabe lately.
Yeah, it's been a while, hasn't it?
We've winter breaked.
but entertainment hasn't.
It's just kept on going on.
It has indeed, yeah. Hasn't it? And so there's quite a lot to talk about. We're going to kick off tonight with, well, the 9th or 10th, depending on how we're counting.
Oh, okay.
Or possibly even 11th, depending on exactly how we're counting. film from Quentin Tarantino.
Yes.
This is the inelegantly titled Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And it's not just once, I mean, it's several times upon a time. There's a lot of time in this film.
Yeah. Steve has been thoroughly entertained by an Auckland production of Six Degrees of Separation.
Absolutely. Now, we've been a little bit down on Her Highness Emma Thompson recently, which is obviously heretical. Simon has been looking into restoring our faith.
Yes.
How are we feeling about
faith has been restored.
The Blessed Mother Emma has been restored to her status. This is good.
This is as a result of her work in a film called Late Night.
Right.
We're also going to hear tonight, or today, or whenever you're listening or watching us, about a Scottish pop singer called Tom Walker.
Yes.
Who's just been in the country.
He has indeed.
Mm-hmm.
And then also we've got... speaking of royalty, I don't know there was Thompson. You yes. can't move for Queen lately, can
no,
you?
No.
So we had Bohemian Rhapsody last year,
yes.
And now I think probably on the back of that we've got a new a production of We Will Rock You, is playing even as we see, probably on stage in about half an hour at the Bruce Pullman Centre in Takapuna in Auckland, and there are things that need to be said about it.
The tone of your voice
gives nothing away. Whatsoever.
Gives nothing away.
Not a sausage, mate. Not a single thing. No.
All right.
Let's start. What you're imagining.
Let's start with Quentin Tarantino. As you say, Steve, his 9th or 10th or 11th films. Maybe it's his last, but maybe not. It's Once Upon a Time ... in Hollywood.
Yes.
Let's maybe get the ball rolling with just a quick sort of thought, whether we liked it or not, from each other. For you, are you a fan of him?
I have been a massive Quentin Tarantino fan ever since I first saw Reservoir Dogs.
Okay.
And that's going back, 20 odd years now. I'm a big fan. I like what he does. I think he's a phenomenal writer as well as being an amazing director. So that's where I'm coming from.
Right.
Full disclosure from the start.
Yes.
But I sense the howevers.
Oh, no. So did you enjoy this one, though?
Oh, this one? Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, I will say I enjoyed a great, great deal of it.
There's the but.
Well, this is something we can talk about. I just, part of the film, and especially the story, left me, I guess, a little uneasy.
Okay.
And to be honest, I'm going to be honest here, a little puzzled. And a little bit unsure of what to make of what I was watching.
Okay, well, I can see where you could get that.
Yeah, so I will rely on your expertise to maybe guide me. But we should maybe just set the scene again with just a little bit of the characters, the main characters, what's going on. This is set in 1969 Hollywood.
Yes, it is.
The central characters are the TV cowboy Rick Dalton.
Ah, oh, yes.
As played by Leonardo DiCaprio.
Played quite wonderfully.
Yeah, and his stunt double,
yep.
Cliff Booth,
mm-hmm.
as played by Brad Pitt.
Yes.
And so in the film, Dalton's star is kind of fading somewhat. Mm-hmm. He's been in TV. He's looking to get into movies to keep that career going. And Cliff Booth, his stunt double, is more than just that. He's a mate. He's his driver. He's his fixer, his minder. He's kind of a go-to guy for him, isn't he?
Well, the voiceover early on, I think it was even in the trailer, but the voiceover describes him as more than a friend, less than a wife.
That's right.
And those two spark off each other quite gloriously,
they do.
Don't they?
Yeah.
They need to be in films together.
They do.
They're very, very good.
So part of the film is just following Rick and Cliff negotiating their way through trying to each keep their own careers going and surviving in Hollywood. Along the way, Cliff happens to meet a young woman who, as it turns out, is part of Charles Manson's so-called family, that sort of cult group that achieved notoriety around the world in 1969. Because, and this isn't giving too much away because
it's not
a real event.
This is historical fact.
In 1969, that family...
Mm-hmm.
killed the American actress Sharon Tate, who was heavily pregnant at the time, and several of her friends in Los Angeles on the day that Tarantino sets his film.
Yes.
And Sharon Tate is in this film.
Yes, she is.
As played by Margot Robbie.
Yes, she is. And also played by herself.
Tell me.
Well, do you not remember the one scene where Margot Sharon right. goes to the cinema?
Yes.
To see herself.
Yes.
In The Wrecking Crew.
Yes. Oh, and right.
And if I'm not mistaken, that's yeah. actual footage
of Sharon Tate.
Of Sharon Tate yes. in The Wrecking Crew on screen. And then there's Margot Robbie Sharon, who is enjoying the audience responding to Sharon on the screen.
Right, you're so, right. Yes, yes, yes. So
typically Tarantino meta.
Yeah. So that's kind of the setting of it.
Yeah.
We're not going to give away too much about what happens at the end, of course. But tell me what... So I'll get to my sort of misgivings, but you tell me, please,
go on.
What worked for you? Why did you so enjoy this?
Well, I'll confess that to begin with, in the first maybe hour, it did cross my mind that possibly it was a bit baggy. Because, as you say, you've got Rick Dalton, the Caprio character, who has made the decision to leave the show that he leads.
Yes.
What was it called? Bounty Law,
yep.
To try and get into films. And he's really not making a good fist of it.
No.
And he's regretting the decision. And you can tell because he starts to develop a little bit of stammer when he's speaking because his confidence is taking a kicking. And there's moments in there when you just have to make a conscious decision. I'm just gonna go with it. I'm just gonna let this take me with it because it is slow.
Mm.
It's a very, very nicely done slow. At the same time, you've got in parallel, you've got Cliff, you've got Brad Pitt's Cliff, who is supposedly best mate, but he's actually a hanger-on almost, and certainly a helper.
Yes,
bopping around the valley, trying to make a go of things. And that strand of the story I found more interesting. I thought that was really nicely done.
Yeah. I just want to talk a little bit more about that the slow setting. This was quite... it's hard not to miss it. And it's, in a way, kind of un-Tarantino-esque because he takes his time with the shots.
Yes, he does.
I've heard this film described as a homage to Hollywood, and it is.
Very much so.
The setting, the cars, the wardrobes, the music, the hairstyles, the language.
Everything.
It's just, you feel like you're in Hollywood at that time.
Oh,
so
yes.
It's beautifully done.
Yes.
And there's lots of time for the shots to breathe. Like you mentioned his love of dialogue.
Mm.
I thought... Especially, there's at times there's not much dialogue here at all.
No,
you're listening to the songs, but you're not necessarily listening to the characters.
You're listening to the songs. You're looking at the lighting.
Yeah,
the framing of
beautiful.
Every single shot. There isn't a single item anywhere on the screen that's out of place. Everything is perfect. But what it doesn't have, I mean, think back to Reservoir Dogs and just like you know the famous opening scene in the cafe before they go off and. The bank job goes wrong, and there's those incredibly quotable lines when they're talking about Madonna and they're talking about whether or not you should tip, and there's none of that.
No,
there's very, very little of that trademark Tarantino.
Yep.
Quotable lines, not so much.
One I remember that in this film was, and it, just because it was so anti-PC was when Brad Pitt's character is trying to console. Dalton, and he says, "Don't cry in front of the Mexicans," or something like
yes.
that. Something
yes,
something like that.
He had his moments of being a little bit.
Yes, but I didn't, Steve. I didn't mind the slowness of it because it was beautiful to look at and to listen to. Because what we should say is, as all this is slowly developing, you are given Tarantino puts on the screen.
Yeah.
The day, the date.
Yes.
The day of the week, the date. And then the time of the day. So he
yes.
is setting up and you're seeing Sharon Tate. So if you've seen the trailer and you've got any knowledge of what happened to Sharon Tate, you are being given a sense of foreboding.
Oh, very much so,
a
yes.
sense of trepidation, what's going to happen next. So the fact that the beginning of the film is a little slow, and for me, didn't matter that much because I've got the sense of, uh-oh, we're building up to something here.
Yeah.
Hang on, what's going to come? And I think... And that at the end of the film, though, that's where I was left a little confused because he went to the trouble of giving you the sense of almost a docudrama, in a way.
Yeah. Now,
but except...
Do be careful.
I am. I'm not going to say anything more. Except he's given you two fictional characters in Brad Pitt's character
yes.
and Leonardo DiCaprio's character
yeah.
in a real story that actually happened.
Okay, I can see how that can be...
So I got a little bit
yeah.
a little bit confused about how I was meant to be reading that.
Yes, at the same time, there is one astonishingly well-staged scene where Cliff Booth picks up one of the Manson family girls.
Yes.
And ends up driving her to, and I don't know if, I wasn't aware of this until I just read it the other day, the Spahn Ranch.
Yes.
Where they were hanging out. That's actually where the Manson family lived.
That was it.
That literally was it. Wow. Yeah, apparently.
Okay. Yeah.
And so obviously they're using it as the place where a Rick Dalton would have made shows like A Bounty Law.
Right.
But that was actually where the Manson family was. Who, if I'm not, did he ever actually identify as Charles Manson explicitly in the film? I'm trying to remember.
I don't think so.
I think we were just meant to know that. I think maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
They never actually used the name.
No.
But they did have the family there.
Yes. And we have a brief glimpse of someone who we would assume is...
Yes. Well, he's Charles. He's Charles.
Charles. Yes.
That's all he is. They have, some of them have names.
Yes.
One I did notice, they called her Sundance.
Yes.
I noticed at the end very nicely in the credits, the woman who played Sundance, her name was Cassidy. Ah. So that was a lovely little detail.
And I think one of the other characters in the family in the film is called Tex.
Yes.
And I think Tex was the name of one of the actual members of the family.
Right.
So I think... So there's an attention to detail there.
Yes.
And if particularly for Americans who are from California who knew of the Manson
yes.
thing, yeah, I can imagine them sort of... thinking, okay, where's Mr. Tarantino taking us? And yes. We're not going to say what happens at the end, but it's an ending that is a surprise. I think that you could say that.
It's certainly a shocker.
A shocker. And I just felt, what do I make of that? What am I taking from this film? I was entertained a lot, but just felt a little puzzled.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you,
go on.
As a long-time aficionado,
go on.
We know Tarantino is a man who has... encompassed and embraced the use of violence in his films.
Yes, he has.
Sometimes it's with almost a comic book effect. Other times it's a more sort of graphic and grisly effect.
Yep.
For most of this film, I don't want to give too much away, but for most of this film, he's not taking us into that realm. Would that be fair?
Yeah, there's
certainly in terms of physical violence.
No, there is. I think what he does instead of that, rather than let's say, for example, if you look at Pulp Fiction,
yeah,
it's nasty.
Yeah,
Reservoir Dogs. Straight after the opening music, you've got Tim Roth bleeding out of the back of a car, and it's downhill from there.
Glorious Bastards is full of violence.
Exactly, they all are. But no, this one's in so many ways, it's his most understated film.
Yes,
because as we said, you've got you're shown Charles, and you're shown Charles and you're shown Sharon Tate, so you know what's coming.
Yes,
at that point, you don't need to have people. Having things sliced into their heads or ears sliced off. You don't need that because you've got the terror.
You do. But if you've seen the trailer or looked up online about this film, you'll see a reference to graphic violence. So I think that we can say that there is a scene of graphic violence. Well, I won't say when it happens or who's involved in it, but I will say it didn't, to me, necessarily fit in the flow of the film because the character who perpetrated it...
Yes.
I'll withdraw that a little bit because I'll say that character, we do see that character has a propensity to use violence in some ways, but it's at such a level when it comes that it is shocking.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if it necessarily fitted with what we were seeing up until that point.
Right. I know where you're going with that one. Mm. We shall discuss that in a more spoiler-safe environment.
Maybe we should.
Because I have thoughts about that, but I don't want to say it on mic.
Okay, all right.
Seriously. There are other things to mention.
Yes.
We have to mention, in terms of the acting, Julia Butters.
Which character did Julia Butters play?
Put it this way. She's 8 years old.
Oh, okay, yes.
This is what's his name? Rick Dalton's co-star.
Yes.
In the film that they're making. And she says that she's 8. And there's the most astonishing scene where he's terrified that this could be his last chance. And if he blows this last chance and he's blown his career, and he finally pulls together a terrifying scene full of massive tension. And at the end of it, after he's flung her to the floor, she comes to me and says, "That's the best acting I've seen in my whole life."
Yeah, yeah.
And she's perfect.
Very good.
And so is he for that matter.
The scenes where Leonardo DiCaprio is going through, they're filming a take.
Yes.
And he has to redo it. But the way that they let that, the camera's with him all the way through.
Yes.
There's a stumble and he has to pick up and do it again. I thought that was great acting by DiCaprio. Really, really nice. But I agree with you, actually, in the emotional heart of the story was much more, for me, was much more with Brad Pitt's character than with DiCaprio's character.
Yeah, okay.
I just found, maybe it's because the Pitt's character was drawn more into the Manson thing, that that was where the interest was a bit more than another an actor struggling to keep his career going sort of story was not so engaging. A couple of things that struck me, given that in 2019 we're talking about the 50th anniversary of Woodstock, and 1969 when this film is set is when Woodstock actually happened 50 years ago. Hippies make an appearance in this film, as they did at Woodstock. They ain't good guys necessarily in this film at all.
They are spoken of quite disparagingly, aren't they? Yes.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
It's true.
And I just want to mention one other thing, because the very week that I saw this film, I also started to watch the second season of an American program that shows here on Netflix called Mindhunter.
You've mentioned this
which
in the past.
The first season I thought was excellent. Yeah. It's set in the late 70s, early 80s, and it follows the development of the FBI's behavioral analysis unit, the ones that actually worked up profiles about serial killers. And in this later season, there's a couple of episodes dealing with Charles Manson.
Oh, Lordy.
In detail about what his followers actually did in the real murders.
I'm not sure I actually want to see that.
Well, it's not pleasant.
No, it wouldn't be. Is it well done?
It's very well done. Okay. And the interesting thing about this, sorry, I'm digressing a little bit. We'll come back. But the really interesting thing about this series is it deals with such violent, disturbing material, but 90% of it is just unfolding in front of you in an interview.
Right.
So what these guys, these men, the detectives do is they just go and interview imprisoned serial killers to find out what makes them tick. So you're not seeing a huge amount of blood and gore. Yeah. There's no action, people being hit or killed or stabbed. There's some, you see some photographs, some crime scenes, but that's it. And it's absolutely gripping, nevertheless.
It does sound quite brilliant.
It's beautifully shot and produced. So that's a sidebar. But
I'll give that a look. So speaking of dodgy criminals.
Yes.
Roman Polanski.
Yes.
Figures quite prominently.
Yeah.
Because he has to. Because as we've said, you know, this is partly a document of the moment. You know, you got Steve McQueen.
Yes.
Played by Damian Lewis. Quite brilliant.
Yeah, it was very well done.
Didn't you love the bit where there's a suggestion at one point that Rick Dalton was offered Steve McQueen's role in The Great Escape and they deepfaked him into Oh, that was... Great Escape's one of my favourite films.
Oh, okay.
I love that
Now, there's
film.
lots to savour in this film.
There is. But one of the things I did like was that there was a quick dig about Polanski. If you remember when Cliff's driving Pussy was her name,
Okay.
The young lady.
Yes.
Before she gets in the car, is the most gratuitous arse shot in a film. I mean, it really was.
Oh, yes, yes.
Like I said, nothing's done by chance in a Tarantino film. And the arse shot was done quite deliberately.
Yeah.
But then she offers to repay him for the ride back to the ranch with sexual favours.
Yes.
Which he declines because she's underage. I think that was put in there for a very specific reason.
Speaking of that, there's one more little sidebar to this film we should talk about, because it got quite a bit of publicity a week or two ago when the family of the late Bruce Lee came out to complain about the way in which Bruce Lee was portrayed in the film. He's there for a little bit. It is Bruce Lee who's there showing.
It's very explicitly and specifically Bruce Lee.
And I think that what they complained about was that they felt his character was shown to be rather narcissistic, arrogant, shallow person, not the deep thinking martial artist, the philosopher that perhaps some of the world would like to be.
You mean a movie star?
Yeah, yeah. So I actually, I've seen a couple of Bruce Lee films. I've had this sort of image in my mind of him being a sort of a, I don't know, he's an icon, isn't he? He's an icon of the time. So I actually did find the portrayal a little odd, but anyway, that's Tarantino's take on it.
It is indeed. I was okay with it. I've never been a huge, how should we say, aficionado.
Yes.
Anyway, so I wasn't too concerned about that. But yeah, I mean, who else is even worth mentioning? I mean, there's so many people are in this. I didn't even notice that Dakota Fanning was in it.
No, I didn't either.
No.
I saw her in another. I quite liked Kurt Russell's little cameo. Yeah. That was all right. And in fact, he's the narrator, isn't he? I'm pretty sure that's his voice who's narrating.
Yes, I think it is. Yes, that would make sense.
And that narration is another reason that gives the movie that sort of slightly docudrama sort of feel.
Yes.
Like it's... Anyway. So I think... I will say... I was left puzzled, a little uneasy, but I savoured the experience while it was there. There's a lot to it's the sort of film you might want to go back a second time and see it.
I'm planning to, yeah.
Yeah, because there's visually, and as you just talked about, some of the detail that I think I missed the first time around, you could get a lot more out of it another way, another go around.
And it's a 2.75-hour film.
Yeah.
And it's worth seeing again. Yeah. So, I mean, ultimately, what would you say? Would you recommend it?
I would.
Is it for Tarantino completists, or is it for a general audience?
Ah, that's a good question. It's definitely for Tarantino completists. Oh.
Guilty as charged, definitely. But
I would say that there's going to be a bunch of people who are just not going to understand what happens at the end.
Yeah, okay, I'll go with that.
And might be a bit disturbed and even upset or puzzled or maybe even a bit angry about it.
Okay.
But it's a hell of a ride.
Isn't it just?
Yeah, so I recommend it.
Fair enough. I think I'll probably go along with that, yeah.
Okay. So, Mr. Tarantino, we've done that.
I'm sure he'll feel better about that. I'm sure he won't be sleeping until he's heard this review. Don't worry, Quentin. You're all good, mate. Yeah.
Now, apart from the movies, you've been to the theatre, haven't you?
I have indeed, a couple of times, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things you've seen just recently is this play set in Auckland, produced in Auckland.
Yes.
It's 6 Degrees of Separation, which I remember as a movie 20-something years ago with Will Smith in it.
Yeah, when he was still Will Smith. When he was still the Fresh Prince,
basically. Yeah, and I think Donald Sutherland was in it and a few others. So it's in Auckland, and you've just seen it, and I'm really interested to know what you make of it.
Well, it was playing at the ASB Waterfront Theatre. I say was, it still is. In fact, it's playing until August the 30th. So we've still got over a week to go and see it.
Yeah.
And I would recommend that you do.
Oh, okay.
Very good. You know, I mean, obviously, stage production is always going to be different from a screen production, yes, obviously. So it's a very, very pared back stage set in, you know, the first half of the film basically set in their living room. Mm. So the set is a sofa. There's a sofa. It's a living room. That's it. It's very simple. The two main characters, I'm checking my notes here, obviously. Yeah?
Yes.
Jennifer Ward-Leland.
Yes.
I mean, she owns this. It's her performance, her production, ultimately. She plays Weezer, the wife of Andrew, played by, Flanner, beg your pardon, played by Andrew Granger, right? So these two are a couple who are in their Manhattan apartment, enjoying their wealth, which is basically about to collapse if they're not careful. And along comes, now what was his name? Paul, played by Tane Williams-Acra. And Paul is a young black lad who claims to be, among other things, son of Sidney Poitier, best mate at college of Weezer and Flan, and just been mugged. And he inveigles his way into their lives, and they help him out, and it's all a big scam. And then it turns out that he's been pulling this scam elsewhere. It's based on a true story.
Yes, yes. And it was a play originally before it became that
film. It was indeed, yeah. And the thing is, I mean, you know, when was it first produced? 88, I think it was? 89? So it's from a pre-information era age, where people can make claims, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, if somebody said there was Sidney Poitier's son, would you know how many sons Sidney Poitier had?
I could go...
Exactly, you could, couldn't you? But without...
Oh, right, yeah.
You wouldn't be able to.
No, no.
And so this is set in a time that you and I both remember, but when there was no internet where you could just Google Sidney Poitier and sons and find out the veracity of his claim. So the story is really, really ingenious,
but it's
based on a number of scams that this man pulled off.
And is part of it, Steve, because I read your review on cravepodcast.com, our website.
Absolutely.
It's about the couple almost wanting, they almost want to believe it because it's almost getting them close to celebrity.
This is one of the most glorious things about it. When it was first written, now what was the name of the bloke who wrote it? I need to check this.
Because you want a Pulitzer Prize for it, I think.
Yes, John Guare, I believe he's pronouncing it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Paul, the purported son of Sidney Poitier, dangles in front of them is that his father is putting on a movie production of Cats.
Okay.
Which is, and apparently that was in the original. This is not something they updated to make it work
right
in a contemporary way. This was in the original screenplay, and they're that dangled in front of them is the possibility that they might have bit parts in the film production of Cats, which had the audience howling with laughter. And the two leads, they do. There's an awful lot of talking directly to the audience. The fourth wall just gets shattered.
Okay.
And they milk that,
right?
Because you know they were girding to the audience because they knew how what you know purely by chance. This is comedy gold right now. and so they were superb. Jennifer Ward Leland, I want to get her name right, and she deserves having her name got right because she's brilliant.
Yeah. She's probably, I mean, she's been in the New Zealand theatre and film and TV for a number of years.
Yeah.
I think she's probably our premier actor in many ways. Well, certainly on stage.
I was very fortunate to have the chance to see her in this because her character has to have sort of archness and tartness and at the same time just the tiniest bit of vulnerability so that she needs, like we say, something in her life that can and the way she managed to pull all that, I was really, really impressed with it.
Okay. Wow.
And the entire cast were fantastic, but you know, she was first among equals.
Great.
I would definitely recommend it.
I think I better go and see it then.
Do. British band Squeeze will be coming to New Zealand in February of 2020. So I caught up recently with Glenn Tilbrook, singer, songwriter, frontman for the band, and he talked about who's coming to New Zealand and what we can expect from the shows when they get here.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you doing today?
Very good, thank you.
Good. And where are you today?
I am in Greenport, Long Island, in the US.
What takes you to the US at the moment? Are you touring?
We're not touring until 2 weeks' time. I'm just here preparing for the tour and having a bit of holiday with my family.
Oh, that sounds good. And so you're going to be touring for a while. You're coming down to New Zealand in February, I understand. But not the whole band.
Well, we have Chris Difford can only fly under duress.
Ah, okay.
So we came to Australia last year, a year before, I can't remember exactly when, and we did a tour as a five-piece with Chris's blessing, because the deal is either, you know, we can't go or we can go without Chris,
right.
Really. He is a basket case when it comes to flying.
Fair enough.
Long distance. So... we toured in Australia, and the reception we had was just amazing. You know, it's still, you know, obviously, I'd rather have Chris, but you know what? Without Chris, it works just fine.
Fair enough. I mean, we could get into philosophical questions of without you and Chris on stage together, is it truly Squeeze?
Well, you could say that, but I think that people will know it is truly Squeeze, and that we put on a brilliant show. So I have no qualms about that.
Nah, fair enough. I mean, it's interesting because his lyrics are terribly, terribly personal. So does it ever feel a bit weird singing? I mean, songs like Up the Junction basically is the shortest Ken Loach film ever. Does it ever feel weird singing those songs without him next to you?
No, because I've been so intrinsically involved in those songs, and you know, from when I met Chris when I was 15, you know, he and I were writing songs together.
Right.
I mean, separately rather, and it was blindingly obvious that he was a way better lyricist than I was, and that I was a better tunesmith than he was. So
oh, fair enough.
It was a natural fit. But yeah, I mean, really, it was a match made in heaven.
Okay, fair enough. So tell me about the songs that you're going to be performing on this tour. I know it's been, in New Zealand at least, it's being billed as the Songbook Tour. So are we looking at like sort of a greatest hits set, or are you promoting the new material?
We're going to be playing everything, you know. It's this is the first tour that we've done, you know, in our sort of greater scheme of things, without a new record for 4 years. And we did two albums in 2015 and 2017, you know, which I'm immensely proud of, and I think dispel any notions about whether our writing's gone soft or not, because it definitely hasn't. But, you know, equally, we have such a great catalogue of songs, some of which you know, we haven't done for a long time, and all of which, of course, we've never done in New Zealand. So, you know, it's a really good career-spanning set that we've put together.
Okay. Any surprises we can look forward to? Or I guess if you tell me now, there won't be surprises. But
it wouldn't be surprises if I told you about them. But we do have definitely, you know, as I said, the band is so sparky at the moment. It's really great, you know. If I look back on Squeeze in the 90s, I think we were like a sort of lobster boiling slowly, and we sort of gradually took our eye off the ball.
Okay.
When I look back on not our records, but our live shows, it was just like we got complacent. And it was a lesson to me to never, ever want to do that again. And, you know, we're definitely not.
So you're not going to fall into the trap of, say, playing Cool for Cats in its entirety, for example?
Oh, we will be definitely playing Cool for Cats. Steve Smith, who plays percussion with us, has already rehearsed the role of Chris Tiff, and he does a brilliant job. So,
right.
Absolutely.
Well, I meant doing the album song for song.
What's that?
What I was referring to was doing the entire album. That seems to be a thing for some bands these days, of playing their classic albums straight through.
Oh, right. No, we're not doing that.
Okay, those are dismissed out of hand, fair enough. Actually, tell you what, since we're on the subject of Cool for Cats, I do have a question that's been bothering me ever since. I actually had a copy of Cool for Cats on pink vinyl when it came out as a single back in 79.
Okay.
And there's one thing that's always bothered me about it. You sing that the scores with the corporal, she's tied against the tree, but then you sing that she lets loose all the horses. How does she do that?
That's she concealed a razor blade in the headband that she was wearing.
I'll allow it. Fair enough. I've always wanted to ask you guys that question. So let me ask you about the album you brought out about 9 years ago, Spot the Difference. This was a sort of revisiting of some of your biggest hits, wasn't it? What prompted you to revisit those songs?
What? Sorry?
So what prompted you to revisit those songs?
Oh, well, just because we didn't have ownership of any of our masters, and we thought it would be good to promote alternative means for people to get to our catalogue without involving a hefty discount due to Universal owning our stuff. I don't resent that. That's just the way the business is.
Yeah.
But so we presented a credible alternative, and I must say, it was not a fun album to record. It was more like being a detective trying to track down exactly what we did, how we did it, the amps we used, guitars, and
right.
And then, to, you know, so all that stuff, it was like a big research project. And I couldn't say I entirely enjoyed doing it. What I did enjoy was the end result, because we stuck at it really dogmatically. And we did at least as good versions, although, of course, in many people's eyes, nothing's as good as the original version. And I get that. But say with a song like Black Coffee in Bed, the Spot the Difference version is way, way better than the original version. But
In what way?
Well, it was a sort of sloppy band performance and not a very good vocal by me. And it's slightly ponderous, in my opinion, although it did well for us in America. So the biggest compliment I can pay to myself is that I was in a restaurant and Black Coffee in Bed came on, and I thought, oh, that's Black Coffee in Bed, fair enough. Thought nothing more of it. And it was three quarters of the way through until I realised it was the Spot the Difference version.
So what you're telling me is you yourself couldn't literally spot the difference?
What I'm telling you is exactly that. I didn't spot the difference because I was caught unawares. And thought, oh, yeah, that's that song. And I thought, hold on, this isn't the original. That's how far it took me to get there.
That's fantastic.
I was proud of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You obviously achieve what you're looking to do. I mean, I know some bands like to sort of reimagine and rework their old stuff. It's fascinating to see you trying to do it that closely.
No, I mean, the idea was always to do it as closely as possible. You know, the whole point of doing it was to get them to sound like the originals, or if we could improve them, you know. But that would, the improvement would be sonically, nothing else.
Right. But, I mean, at the very least, you know, your voice would have been, what, 30 years older? Did you not find that your voice had matured, let's say?
No, you're perfectly entitled to ask that. I can still sing everything in exactly the same range as the records, which I'm lucky for, you know. I don't know how long that's going to last, but right now I'm in the same key for everything. But what has changed is the tone of my voice. That's the thing I noticed.
Okay.
But, yeah. It's more gruff tone now than it was.
Okay.
That's the effect of aging, but pitch, I'm still there.
Fantastic. So we're talking about Spot the Difference, and I know you've got Goodbye Girl on there, and now and on the Spot the Difference version, she's now moved to Guernsey. I noticed she does seem to move to a number of different places. She had to go into Boston at one point. Was that an attempt to break into the lucrative Lincolnshire market?
Yeah, we were trying to widen our market a bit as much as possible. So.
Yeah, because I can't help but feel that a song like, say, Up the Junction would really, really confuse the Americans. So changing one word in Goodbye Girl seems funny.
Oh, yeah, but it was limited words, wasn't it? I think I've always thought the thing about songwriting, like any sort of storytelling, is that you needn't know the location, even if it's very location specific, like up the junction is, the stories are always human. And I hate to sound like sort of some Hollywood person saying that, but it's true. And I think that in a sense, that if you're singing about places that are unknown to people, they paint their own pictures of it. And that in itself is great.
Ah, fair enough. Fair enough. Because I mean, some of the stories that you tell in your songs are quite lovely. I mean, Labeled with Love always bears close listening.
Mm. Yeah, I mean they're quite specific, and that's Chris's talent. You know, that was I think based on a documentary he saw about war widows who had married American soldiers from World War II.
Oh, fair enough.
And you know, committed their lives to go and live somewhere else, and you know, so.
Right.
Like you have, Steve. How long have you been in New Zealand?
Me, I've been here for about 10 years now. It's home now.
Okay, that's good. Where did you come from?
Oh God, originally Manchester, Salford.
Right. So did you move around before settling in New Zealand?
A little bit, yeah. My wife's American. We moved here from Florida, and. Have you been to New Zealand yet?
Yes, I came in 2001, but that was on a solo tour. I think I did one date, and it was just after 9/11. It was a very weird time, and I remember all the tributes that were posted up to people there. It was a very strange but moving time, and it was lovely being there. Eternal regret that I've not been back since, but I'm glad we're coming back now.
Well, no, you've got a very short visit here. You're doing three dates before you head over to Australia. We'll be seeing you in Auckland on the 7th of February. That should be nice.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, you got any plans to explore the country while you're down here?
You know, if I get some time, I would love to go out and explore and, you know, just see a bit more of the country than I did the last time around. So hopefully, yeah.
Fair enough. And when you get back off the tour, I noticed that, you know, you guys have been recording quite extensively recently. You know, Spot the Difference was 2010, but then you got Cradle to the Grave in 15 and
2015, Knowledge,
2017. What's coming next?
Yeah. Well, what's next, you know, is that I'm extremely proud of those records, but I'm referring to records. And records are sort of, not exactly a thing of the past, but, you know, what we do is, because times have moved on, and I accept that completely, we have lost the notion of shared experience, and the chance of the shared experience for records, I think, has greatly diminished.
Okay.
The availability of streaming, everything is great. So I really want Squeeze to carry on and record, but I think we have to attach ourselves to a project like a movie or a TV series in order to get some traction, because, you know, even that experience is diversified, but I think that's where music gets an in these days.
So are we talking about doing a soundtrack or a score or something?
Yeah, a soundtrack, a score, whatever. I mean, I'd love to do that, and, you know, Squeeze can do that. We can do songs for that. It's just, it's hard for a standalone record to really garner any attention. We've got to think of other ways to do it. There's always the musical outlet too, which is something we're looking at.
So are we looking more at sort of the Rocket Man Bohemian Rhapsody axis, or closer to Mamma Mia? Where are we leaning here?
I think neither of those is a template, you know. I think there's a story to be told in success and failure. It doesn't have to be career, massive highs and lows. You know, we've sort of chundered along the middle ground for a long while whilst experiencing success. And, you know, indeed, in the UK and the US, our ticket sales are higher now than they've ever been.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. That's amazing for a band who's been recording since 1978, isn't it?
You know, it's one of those things. It's one of the anomalies of the times that we live in, and never criticise change because it's always been happening, you know. And weirdly enough, we seem to have benefited from that.
Right. Well, listen, time is getting the better of us. So, Glenn Tilbrook from Squeeze, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us today. We appreciate it.
Oh, honestly, Steve, I really appreciate talking to you. It's been really instructive and interesting. Thank you.
Right, well, you still are with Crave, but our cast has changed somewhat. Steve's left for a little break, and Debbie, our specialist pop correspondent.
Right.
Can I call you that?
Sure.
Has joined us for a chat about a show that's just taken place, Debbie, in Auckland.
Yes.
Look, I'll be honest. I hadn't heard of Tom Walker from Scotland. Tell me about him.
I actually hadn't heard of him before myself.
Okay.
A friend actually told me about him, and I thought, well, he sounds kind of interesting. So I just looked him up. I thought, okay, sounds good. So he was playing at the Power Station, which is one of my favorite venues. So I thought, this sounds like it could be a good show. And it was.
You liked him. Okay.
I
so
did.
Why did you like him?
I liked him because he's an amazing vocalist, really good. Really big range, great voice. He was very personable. Talked to the crowd, you know, that kind of stuff. He had an amazing band too. His drummer was unbelievable.
Okay.
Yeah, he was really good.
Can I just ask you about that? Because I've seen a lot of pop bands, but the ones I have seen since I've been on Crave, often they're minimalist bands with heavy on, you know, organ or keyboards,
and you don't
actually see a drummer or a bass player. It's just one or two people playing keyboards, as I say. What sort of a band did he have?
Well, it was a little bit more like that. So he had one guy on keyboards. Another one was on a small, I'm not really sure. He's on some kind of a small little machine. It must have been some kind of synthesizer type thing. He had a backup singer.
Right. He did play, you say?
What's that?
A drummer, as
you say.
Yeah,
an amazing drummer.
Yeah.
And then he played guitar on a few of the songs. Yeah. Okay. He actually played drums on one song. Oh. It was kind of a little, you know.
A shtick.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, what about the songs he played? Are we talking about, I hesitate to use the word typical, but you know, romantic pop? Is that what the area he delves in, or...?
I'm not really sure. Yeah, I guess there were a few songs like that.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of reminded me a little bit of Passenger, sort of that genre. Singer-songwriter, kind of writing about whatever captured him at the moment, that sort of thing.
Okay. And he's, whenever you say pop artist, I immediately think they're 18 or 19 years old.
He's 27.
Oh, that's kind of getting on a bit then. tell me a little more about how he engaged with people. Like, I mean... he's from Scotland, I think.
Yes.
Did he have a nice Scottish accent?
He did indeed, yeah. Yep, he did.
People that seemed to go down well, did it?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
So he told the story of one song he had written, I think he said when he was 19, and it was after he had broken up with his girlfriend of 5 years. So,
wow.
I know. That, I'm doing the math. Like, oh my gosh. Okay.
That's not really.
And then it wasn't, so he wrote the song about that breakup.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the songs. And he talked about that just a little bit before the song. He also talked about when he was just starting to kind of get going and he had a bit of money, he walked into a guitar shop and saw this really gorgeous, I think he said $4,000 guitar. And he was like, oh, should I buy this? And he bought this amazing guitar. And he thought for sure, you know, oh, it's not going to sound good, but it sounded amazing. And he loved it. And I can't remember where he was, but it was stolen. So he was out on a gig somewhere, I can't remember where, and it was stolen. So he wrote a song about that. So that was a pretty high energy kind of.
Sounds like he's quite a good raconteur.
Yeah.
And with this, so you mentioned the love song and this song. Mm-hmm. Were they slower ballads, or there's some up tempo stuff as well?
I wouldn't say anything was a really slow ballad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Not that I can recall. Yeah. They were all pretty good, pretty good energy songs. And everybody loved him. The crowd, there were some people that seemed to be really like hardcore fans. So yeah. And there was a real mix of ages too.
Okay.
There were up sort of in the front, where I was, there were quite a few young women, of course, you know, but a lot of them did have their significant other boyfriends with them. But then there were older folks. The woman behind me told me something about one of the songs in her 60th birthday. I couldn't hear half what she said because it was so loud in there.
Yeah.
I saw a couple that looked even older than that. They must have been in their 70s. I'm not sure how they. Yeah.
Hey. There you go.
Yeah. So it was a real range of ages, and both men and women.
Yeah.
And nice. He seemed to be quite popular amongst all of those.
And you had a good time.
Folks. I had a great time. I really enjoyed it.
Fantastic. Well, and if Tom Walker comes back,
I would definitely see him again. In fact, I was thinking he might be one to follow, you know, to watch him.
See how his career develops.
Yeah, and it looks, from what I could tell, that he's on a world tour. I looked at, you know, at all the venues he had been playing, and he had just gotten in from Tokyo and on his way to, I believe it was Melbourne next in Australia. So, and it looked to me like he might have been playing sort of the smaller venues like the Power Station. I just figured that from the names of the venues. But he's one to watch, I think.
Fantastic.
Really
Thanks
enjoyed
for
it.
Lovely. Thank you, Debbie.
You're quite welcome.
Someone to keep an eye on, and Steve's back with us. Hello again, Steve. Still on the stage.
Yes,
you've been to see another musical act,
indeed.
And as we said in our introduction, the behemoth of the juggernaut that is Queen keeps yes. rolling on.
It does.
Does it do? Does it roll in a positive, uplifting direction in this production? We will rock you.
I would so love to have so much positive to say about this. I really would. I really would. Uh-huh. I'm a Queen fan, right?
Yes.
Very definitely. Saw Queen last year with Adam Lambert.
Yes.
Thought that there was an amazing show. Mm-hmm. They're coming back. I will be there when they come back to Auckland next year. I'm looking forward to it. I've got nothing but respect for Dr. Brian May. He has the PhD in astrophysics. You've got to respect the bloke. And this is a band who produced some of the most astonishing music of our lifetimes.
Yeah.
Right? And then there's We Will Rock You.
Yeah. Right. Now, do we have to say, though, this is not a musical where about the people in the band, is it? It's using their music, but it's not...
Yeah, it's what they call a jukebox musical, yeah? Is the expression used for this kind of thing.
Right.
So the canonical example is Mamma Mia.
Right.
Where you have the cast singing the songs of a featured artiste
mm-hmm.
And with a highly contrived story.
Mm-hmm.
And the highly contrived story in We Will Rock You is, as it says at the very beginning, the time is the future. Earth has been renamed, and I hate to have to tell you this, the I Planet, which is just too cheesy for words. Mm. Now, I'm also a fan of Ben Elton.
Yeah, he's
Who wrote the story for this, right? From The Young Ones through to Blackadder, I've been a big fan of Ben Elton. And it occurs to me that he can be utterly, utterly brilliant.
Yes.
But not always.
Okay.
So if you look at, for example, the Blackadder series,
yeah.
very first Blackadder series he wrote himself,
uh-huh.
it was rubbish.
Yeah, I don't remember the first one, you see.
There you go.
Like the others I do.
The other three he wrote with Richard Curtis.
Right.
And between the two, we could probably recite entire episodes. Yeah. We've seen them that many times. Yeah. They were genius.
They were.
And they also had Rowan Atkinson acting them.
Yeah.
And when you've got that combination, you can't go wrong. No. However, he wrote this himself, so we're closer to Blackadder than the later series, right?
Did he write this? Is this an old musical? It's been written quite a long time.
From 2002.
Oh, okay, so
and it's set in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
On the I Planet, where music has been outlawed.
Mm.
Or real music has been outlawed, and the only music you can hear. Is the music that the Gaga girls listen to, and it's pre-programmed pop produced by a company by Global Soft, which is headed up by the Killer Queen. Okay, you're getting the idea, yeah?
Yeah.
Right. But there is a group of people called the Bohemians, who hang out at the Hard Rock Cafe,
okay.
who are desperately trying to figure out, they know that there is music, they just don't know how to find it.
Mm.
And they've been promised there will be a dreamer who will be able to come and find it. And this dreamer turns out to be a guy who rejects his name. They all give him names. So the Killer Queen's name is, and I'm embarrassed, is www.killerqueen@globalsoft/planet. It's just so contrived and forced it doesn't work. It was probably a nice idea that was never followed through. So the Killer Queen is in charge of all the music,
mm-hmm.
and this guy who rejects his ridiculous name and insists he has to be called Galileo Figaro.
Oy vey.
Exactly.
okay.
And who hooks up with another outsider who he nicknames Scaramouche.
Oy. Is Fandango coming up?
Well, he actually calls her Scaramouche Fandango.
Oh, okay, right.
There you go, right? And they manage to make their way. You'll never guess which body of water they cross to get.
The Sea of Galilee or... No?
Sea of Galilee, no. What? Seven Seas of Rye.
Oh, sorry.
Right? A lot of the time, the songs feel shoehorned in.
Yeah, yeah.
They really, really do. The script is not Ben Elton's best work
mm-hmm.
at all. A lot of the ideas he's got, Wembley Stadium figures prominently toward the end, which is reasonable because that's what Queen's finest hour was at Wembley Stadium. But then a lot of the ideas he's got in this eventually showed up in his 2007 novel, Blind Faith. So you can, and that again is one of his weakest novels. This dystopian future thing, he's clearly wanted to do it for a
mm-hmm.
while. And I like his novels, I have to tell you, some of them are brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
This one was not his blessed Blind Faith. It tried far too hard.
Mm.
And the same way, We Will Rock You tries way too hard to be too clever.
Okay.
And it fails.
It's a shame.
But that's the source material.
Yes, sir.
Right? Yep. What we have to do is talk about who's in it.
Right.
Annie Cromer.
Oh, yeah.
Plays the killer queen.
Okay.
And she is a killer.
Yeah.
She's possibly the best thing in it.
Well, she's one of our divas in a way.
Well, there you go.
Pop music and rock music. And I'd be interested to know how you found her voice, because...
Strong.
Well, she's...
Very strong.
Still strong. That's great.
It's strong, even though the microphones were letting everyone down. The sound... I mean, this was the opening night we saw it at the Bruce Mason Centre. And a lot of the time when people were... the cast were silent for a moment, when it was their turn to take a line, you'd miss the first word before the microphone kicked in. Really, really awkward. There were moments when Galileo's voice was too low in the mix and you couldn't really, even though you knew the songs. And occasionally they would change the lyrics slightly to tweak the lyrics to suit the moment, and you couldn't quite figure out what he was singing, which is really unfortunate. Actually, to be fair, it wasn't that unfortunate. What's the guy's name? Probably shouldn't even mention his name, because he was not the strongest thing in it. He was weak. But another one that's definitely worth mentioning is Scaramouche. It's played by a young woman named Bridie Dixie.
Okay.
Who, you might not know the name. No. I know her because I saw her in a local production here of Chicago.
Oh, okay.
Several months ago. And she was outstanding. You say, Annie Cromer is indeed Annie Cromer. But... that notwithstanding, Bridie was probably, she carried it.
Okay.
She was very, very good. Because the Killer Queen character just comes in, does a bit, and goes off a couple of times. Scaramouche is much more of a central character to it, and she's very, very good.
Okay.
Last time I saw her, she was American on stage. This time she was from South London. And I mean, she nails the accents beautifully. These are people who are given nonsense, I tell you, to work with.
Yeah.
And somehow they manage to find something. I mean, I don't think the material deserves the performance it got. And there's one other guy who has to be mentioned.
Yes.
Because they have a live band.
Oh, okay.
Which I thought was really cool.
Oh, that's cool.
And a guy named John Kempt had the impossible task of Brian Maying.
Okay.
I pity the poor bugger who has to play those. But he's got his... You can actually buy, BMG are selling guitars that are modelled on Brian May's Red Special, which is a handmade guitar. He built that himself. So you can buy a BMG Super is modelled on that. And I'm pretty certain that's what he was playing. It certainly sounded like it.
Right.
To the extent that he came into the audience, the band are up above the stage. Most of the time they're in darkness, you can't see them. But he actually came down when they did We Will Rock You, which is all about the guitar solo at the end. And he came down to the middle of the cast to play the guitar break at the end, and it was perfect.
So he was definitely not unkempt.
He was not unkempt. He knew what our suit through.
Okay, right.
He was superb.
Okay. Great.
The rest of the band were very, very good. But obviously, when you're talking about Queen, the band is going to revolve around the guitar player.
And they
got some superb talent
great
for that. I mean, it's really unfortunate. Bridie was good. Annie was good. Your man John was very, very good. But unfortunately, even with those three, the source material is just so utterly barking. And not even in a good way.
Yeah.
I'd love to be able to say, rush out and buy this. I mean, tickets are $90. It's not even expensive. But it's just, it's the material.
What a shame.
Yeah. I it's so much wanted to love it. I love Queen.
No. Okay. Never mind.
It's nonsense. Yeah. It really, really is. So tell me something good. I mean, speaking of Queens.
Yes.
Because you can't not, right? We have been very down on St. Emma recently, haven't we?
Yeah, Emma Thompson. Well, I think we've talked to her about her a bit lately, and not so much that she's lost her ability, but the projects she's chosen.
Again, it's the material, isn't it? Top talent, rubbish content.
Yes, we saw her in Johnny English Strikes Again.
And Dear Lord.
And then
We wish we hadn't.
And Men in Black International.
Treading Water.
Yeah, I mean, the films were ho-hum at best, and she's still a wonderful...
She's still Emma.
Yeah. So I was very interested to go along and see Late Night.
Yeah.
It's been out for a little while now, but it's worth saying a couple of things about it. the thing that my overriding impression and memory of this film was the way it combined genuinely funny, sharp comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy that was had people like laughing out loud.
Okay.
With some volume.
Okay.
Both in terms of physical comedy and in sharp writing.
Oh, okay.
With genuine drama.
Oh.
And that combination is courtesy of our Emma Thompson.
And rare.
And
done,
rare.
Rare
so,
to find it done well.
So basically she plays a late night TV host called Catherine Newbery. And she's got a creative writing team around her who are bored and come up with the same jokes, and her popularity is waning. And into the mix comes a new writer called Molly, and played by Mindy Kaling, who right. actually wrote the story of the film.
Oh, really?
Okay. And she's a bright, bubbly woman. There's gender politics, there's racial politics. She's an American of Indian origin.
I believe so, yes.
And most of the other characters are male and white.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of office and gender politics going on with some very sharp comedy, as I say. And then you've got her relationship with Emma. And so that plays into Emma being a woman, well advanced into her career.
Yes.
Fighting apparently to stay true to her principles, knowing her popularity is waning.
Yeah.
She's married to Walter, played by John Lithgow.
Oh.
A very good actor.
Oh, yeah.
And Lithgow and Thompson is where the drama in the film comes, because their relationship unfolds in an interesting way.
Yeah.
And it's very... I was surprised. I'd seen the trailer. I expected it to be funny all the way.
I expected it to be sort of like not funny all the way, actually.
Oh, well... Okay, there you are. But it was. But what I mean is, what I expected it to be was a comedy.
Just a straightforward...
Comedy.
Right, right.
But you really actually have... issues about aging, about fidelity. And I thought, really, really good. There was one part of the story that didn't work for me, because Emma Thompson is playing a British woman in America. And at one point, as things are unraveling, she says, "Oh, you Americans," I'm paraphrasing, but something along the lines of, "You Americans, you always just want to spill your hearts out in public and confess all, and as if, you know, we don't do that sort of thing in Britain."
We think a bit too broad strokes.
Well, but then later there's something happens which turns that on its head a little bit, and you're thinking, and so there's a bit of hypocrisy in that. And I guess
again, that's very authentically English.
okay. But it, nevertheless, it was a joy to watch Emma Thompson's work. John Lithgow's a very good actor.
I would imagine those two together.
Yeah, they were great. And if you took those parts, you could have been watching a serious film.
Right.
But it didn't. You might think that wouldn't sit well with the comedy, but for some reason, I thought it did.
Depends on the cast and the actor.
And Mindy Kaling playing Molly is also very, very good and extremely engaging. So it's probably, I think it's still on. And if you're wanting, you know, a little bit of a diversion, I would recommend it. I think it's well worth a look.
Well, I have a very long flight coming up.
Okay.
In about 6 weeks' time.
Well.
And I'm hoping that it might have made it onto airline entertainment.
I probably would have, I'd say.
I'm thinking the timing might be about right. I think I've just figured out what's going to keep me going like at least halfway across the Tasman.
Yes,
excellent.
For sure.
That should be an awful lot of fun, actually. Yeah.
Good. So, let's move on to the next few weeks, Steve.
That was the past.
It was the past. The future involves what sort of...
There's all kinds of good stuff.
Potpourri have we got coming up?
Well, if we're doing cinema first...
Yeah, oh, okay.
I'm not sure how excitement contained we should be here. There's a couple of good previews that you and I are going to be going to see very shortly.
Right.
The Kitchen.
Ah, yes. Okay.
Are we familiar with this?
I've seen the posters, and it's got some good actors in it. Including the the religion Scientologist. That's right, she's a Scientologist.
She's Elizabeth Moss,
but a very good actress.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah,
and the increasingly phenomenal Melissa McCarthy. I never ever thought I'd be saying those words, but it's not a comedy.
No.
And Tiffany Hadid.
Okay.
So it's looking like that's going to be really good. That's coming up shortly.
Yes.
Less promising.
Mm-hmm.
It Part Two.
Yeah. Well, remember when we saw the first one? We both were actually quite disturbed by it, but we thought it was, as horror movies go, a pretty powerful horror movie and disturbing.
But as a film goes, a bit weak.
Yeah, maybe
it was like trying too hard to be Stranger Things and not quite pulling it off.
Okay, I've got to, I have to confess something.
Go on. You've not seen Stranger Things?
I've not seen Stranger.
Not miss much.
Oh, okay.
I've got a wife who loves every second of it, and I don't see it.
Yeah, okay.
I don't get okay. it. Oh, so there you're are. Not missing
but,
much.
But this film from the trailer has got some pretty decent actors in it.
Yes.
James McAvoy's in it, isn't he?
Yeah.
Am I saying his name correctly? So I think, I don't know. Yes, it's another horror movie. It's this. I think it's the same actor playing the clown character.
I think he's Skarsgård. Yeah, yeah. Skarsgård.
I think I'll definitely go to see it just to see.
For the sake of completeness, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll go, but yeah. I'm not holding out much hope.
Yeah, the other one opening in a couple of days, Steve, which I'm not sure what my expectations are. This is this movie made by this super fan of Bruce Springsteen in Britain. The film is called Blinded by the Light, and it's the story of how it's apparently based on his own life and how at a certain age, I think teenagerhood or something, yeah. some mate introduced him to Springsteen and that changed his life.
Well, it would, wouldn't it?
So we'll see.
Right. So in terms of music,
yes. actually,
oddly enough, a lot of the announcements we've got coming up
yeah.
are sort of throwbacks. I mean, there's a couple of modern ones that are worth mentioning.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm wrong with this. Baz or Bass. It's B-A-S. He's a rapper right. from New York. He's coming to Auckland on right. Wednesday, October the 16th.
Mm-hmm.
The studio and then the Meow Bar in Wellington the next night, Thursday, October the 7th. Slightly more big and contemporary, 660.
Okay.
Who you're familiar with, I'm sure. Probably the biggest live band in New Zealand live band at the moment. And they're going to be at Western Springs.
Ah, is that part of a festival?
No, not this one.
Ah, okay.
But they sold out. They did a big thing. It was almost like a mini festival kind of thing at Western Springs last year.
Yes.
They're doing another one. So last year, they sold out Western Springs. Earlier this year, I beg your pardon. Yes. Last season.
Yes.
50,000 tickets they sold out. So they're coming back. So they're going to be there. They've got Ocean Alley.
Right.
Who are quite the up and coming at the moment. Mitch James, Church and AMP. That's Saturday the 22nd of February.
Okay.
That's going to be big.
Okay.
That's going to be really...
I was driving past Western Springs the other day and I saw a poster. And I wasn't sure if someone had done a joke or something. It looked like a festival. I didn't catch the details, but I saw Janet Jackson's name at the top.
This is the Friday Night Jams thing, yes.
Is that Janet Jackson?
Well, how many Janet Jacksons do you know? It's a Janet Jackson who's fallen a hard time. Because yeah. she's sharing a bill with people like 50 Cent.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
And I don't have the information about that to hand, unfortunately, but
okay.
yes.
Right, okay.
It's you know, Janet Jackson.
Yeah.
That the very fellow, yes.
Yeah.
No, apparently, yeah. I can say fallen on hard times, all I can think. Because she's not headlining that, but it's like a mini festival, it's an ongoing thing.
I think there'd be a big curiosity factor for people wanting to see her, I suspect.
Well since it's being discussed, yes. let's look it up.
Okay.
Because Friday Night Jams is a thing that I think it's Frontier, I think, are doing from time to time. They're bringing over people of that end of the musical spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, here we go. This is going to be Friday Night Jams Live 2019.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get some dates, first of all.
Yes.
This is November 2019.
Okay.
I'm not finding a date yet.
Okay, but...
We're looking at Janet Jackson, Black Eyed Peas.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
50 Cent.
Mm-hmm.
Other names that we might be aware of are Jason Derulo, Kerry Hilson, Cisco, Savage, Jaquan... and hosted by Fat Man Scoop.
Okay.
So if you're into that type of music, which personally, I'm not. I don't believe you are either, especially. but yeah, it is Janet Jackson.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm kind of surprised, actually.
I wonder how old she'd be now.
If only there were a way to find out.
If only there was a way. I can't imagine.
I wish I could type the question, how old is Janet Jackson into and see if it'll tell me.
55, 60?
53.
Okay.
And I don't think any of those years have been terribly kind to her either, to be perfectly honest. Oh, okay. So seriously.
All right.
I don't think she's melting as bad as her brother did.
No.
But.
Okay.
But yeah, well, let's move on from that one.
Okay,
Who else have we got? Billy Bragg.
Okay, he's been here one or two times before, I think.
Well, last time he came here, he broke the hearts of a lot of people outside of Auckland because he did three nights in Auckland. And what he did was, it's kind of interesting, he did three different shows.
Okay.
And he's doing the same thing, but this time in Wellington. So what's going to happen is, 28th of May,
mm-hmm.
Thursday night, he's doing a current career-spanning set, it says.
Right.
So, you know, the greatest hits type set.
Yes.
Then on the 29th, on the Friday, he's doing songs from the first three albums.
Okay.
And then the second night, the third night, I beg your pardon, on Saturday the 30th of May, it's songs from the second three albums.
Isn't that interesting?
And he did something very, very similar when he played in Auckland.
Right.
Okay. About a year or so ago. And like I say, people were gutted that he's doing three nights in Auckland and not doing anywhere else. In New Zealand.
Yes.
So he's now, so presumably next year he'll be in Christchurch. We shall assume.
He's redressing the balance.
There you go, yeah. So that's going to be in May at the San Fran in Wellington.
Good.
We've got some American throwbacks.
Okay.
First of all, America.
Oh gosh. That's going back a way.
As I said, yes.
Wow.
Do you think they've named the horse yet?
We've had enough time.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, they went through the entire desert. You'd think they could have come up with a name by the end of that, wouldn't you? But anyway, Christchurch, 22nd of November. Wellington, 23rd of November. Hamilton, 24th. I'm not seeing an Auckland date there, surprisingly.
Oh.
That's unusual.
Uh-huh.
But there you go.
America, gosh.
Yes. Name me a single song other than...
I can't.
No.
I can't. Or, sorry,
you
pass.
You can do magic? You'd know it if you heard it.
Oh, okay.
But other than that, I'm drawing a blank as well, to be absolutely fair. But it is their 50th anniversary.
Okay. Oh, well, yeah, I imagine it would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Randy Newman.
Okay.
Told you going back in... This
yeah.
Time-traveling episodes tonight. Yeah. This got just announced, was it yesterday or today? I think it was yesterday this one came out.
Okay.
Randy Newman's going to be in Auckland at the Civic.
Ah.
Or probably the right venue for him.
Yeah, yeah, it probably is. Yep.
Civic on Sunday the 9th of February. Wellington, 11th of February. The Opera House, Christchurch, the Isaac Theatre Royal on Thursday the 13th of February.
Great. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure I'm desperate to see that myself.
No.
One that you'll like this one.
Okay.
I can tell already. Mm. Alice Cooper's coming back.
Again? Oh. Okay, well... You know, we saw the... Oh, did you come with me for that show?
Yeah, I shot it.
You shot it, that's right.
And you've still not got over his support act, have you? I know where this is going.
I'm glad I saw him because I hadn't seen him before. And, you know, he's a genuine... holds a place in rock history, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He definitely does. I felt at the time...
Yeah.
I felt myself saying, okay, I'm glad I've seen you, Alice... you're still doing it, but you're starting to get a little bit long in the tooth. That was my feeling, just in terms of his energy on stage. And
well, again, I think we need to find out.
And
how old is Alice?
And he had a great band, and
yes.
They were working hard to on stage to kind of give the show that energy.
Yeah. But so, he's 71 years old.
71, yeah.
But he's a complete talent on stage, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. And if you haven't seen him, you should see him because
yes.
he's a piece of history. But I don't think I'd go see him a second time.
The box has been ticked.
I think the box has been ticked.
Nah, fair enough.
But it's interesting that he's coming back. So that yeah.
Okay. So on Thursday the 20th of February,
yeah.
We probably won't be seeing you at the Trust Arena then, no?
That's where he played last time.
It certainly is, yes.
Yeah.
Or indeed, you won't be going all the way down to Christchurch to Horncastle Arena on the 22nd.
No, I won't.
Fair enough then. Better support act this time, though.
Oh well, okay.
Australian band called Airborne. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
I'm not, but they couldn't be worse than the... was it Ace Frehley?
It was Ace Frehley. It was indeed, yes.
The lead guitarist from Queen.
Yes.
That's up there and probably my worst set I've seen since I've been on Crave.
I mean, you were saying that the Alice was a bit creaky and a bit old.
Yeah. Oh.
But Ace Frehley was plodding, wasn't he? Yeah.
Well, he was... up himself in the wrong way.
Yes.
That's my memory of it.
Yes.
And the abiding memory of at one point the band trying to get the audience to sing along.
Yeah.
No one sang.
you have to feel a bit sorry for it, don't
you? You do.
Well,
anyway.
Well, also opening for Alice
is
they're now calling themselves MC50.
Right.
MC5? Motor City 5?
Oh. Okay.
Kick Out the Jams?
Nope. Okay. Showing my ignorance here.
Yeah, they're an American classic rock band. Kick Out the Jams was
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The live version opens with, right now, it's time to kick out the jams, mother.
Okay.
And you can, I'll let you fill in the blanks after
okay.
that. But yeah, quite famous.
Okay.
And they are going to be opening for Alice Cooper.
I'll have to go back to the School of Rock, won't I?
You will indeed.
Which actually is opening quite soon, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, but none of this matters. None of the aforementioned matters in the slightest.
Because?
Canada's finest.
Okay. Though that could have all sorts of meanings. There's a few artists have come out of that fair country.
But none will ever hold a candle to...
Oh, not...
Who?
Not Celine Dion.
No, do me a favor. No, mate, this is not ironic. This is deadly serious.
Oh, I thought you'd be ironic. Sorry.
No, no. No. I one of the best concerts I ever went to.
Yes.
One of the most wonderful concerts. 1990, Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester.
Yeah.
Cowboy Junkies.
Oh. Okay.
I still, when I think about that concert, get shivers down my spine.
Really? Okay.
Yes. Extraordinarily, exquisitely beautiful music.
Okay. I'm there.
Yeah.
You sold me.
Absolutely.
Okay.
They're going to be playing the Bruce Mason Centre, which is probably the right venue for them.
Right.
And they're going to be there 1st of May, Friday.
Okay.
They're also doing Wellington, 2nd of May, Christchurch, Isaac Theatre, May the 3rd. And then they're going off to the West Island as well. Mm. And, I mean, look, their first album, their first breakthrough album, actually their very first album, White's Off Earth Now, actually has a Bruce Springsteen cover on it. State Trooper.
Oh, okay.
But then they recorded their first real album, The Trinity Session, they recorded in the Church of the Holy Trinity.
Oh, okay. I remember you telling me about this.
Toronto.
Yes.
And the single, the big hit from that was Sweet Jane.
Right.
Gorgeous.
Okay.
And apparently the story goes that they recorded it with one single microphone. And the very first song on the album is just Margot Timmins singing a cappella. And then as the album grows, you've got more and more instrumentation. As they figured out the acoustics of the church as they were recording, as the day went by, they worked out how the echoes were working and how they could make the sound of the church work. And so the instrumentation gets that tiny bit. By the end of it, there's drums and bass and guitar and this harmonica.
Isn't that interesting?
Because they were learning how to use the room as it went by. And it's just absolutely gorgeous.
Okay.
Now, the stuff they've been releasing since then, they've done probably about a dozen albums since then.
Mm.
And it's not as sparse, it's not as sort of empty orchestration, but it's still really thoughtful, beautiful music.
Okay.
And Margot Timmins, I swear, she has the voice of every angel ever.
Okay.
It's absolutely extraordinary.
Well, if there's a shop that still sells CDs, I might go out and buy one.
Do.
Okay.
Strongly recommend it.
Okay.
I'll tell you right now, you get either the Trinity Session or you get the Caution Horses.
Okay.
And you will just like weep.
Okay, fantastic.
When you listen. Most beautiful music you'll ever hear.
Oh, there's a lot to look forward to. We have to be a little bit patient to wait for some of it, but nevertheless, that's all good.
Absolutely. Oh,
thank you, Steve.
And also Alice Cooper as well.
Oh, yes. I think we've done our dash. But
I think we've covered a lot of ground there. We
have. Okay. Yeah. So look, we would always be interested to hear from you. You can visit us on our website, cravepodcast.com.
Absolutely.
Where you can email us, podcast@cravepodcast.com.
Got it first time tonight. Well done. We're very proud of you, Simon.
Thank you.
You can find us on the social media where all the cool kids hang out. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you name it, @cravepodcast.
Fantastic. So until next time, I'm Simon Mercier.
I'm Steve McCabe.
You say the last line.
And that's... is what has been entertaining us over the last extended period of time.
Too true.
Right then.